In this episode, we talk to Clint and get an update on his medical situation.
Jamie Stember, chairman of the NBAA CAM Governing Board, and our friend James O'Neill join us to talk about recruitment and retention for corporate flight departments.
We speak to Jake and Lori at Flight Safety International about potential job opportunities for pilots that have lost their medical certificate.
And of course, we'll wrap it all up with a good story.
You're on 121.5, the emergency frequency.
Welcome to the 21.5 Show, a podcast for professional pilots by professional pilots. Join Dylan and Max, both with experience in flight instruction, the airlines, and business aviation, as they talk to a variety of industry experts, share stories, and have a little fun along the way.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the 21.5 Professional Pilots Podcast. I'm here as always with my friend and co-host Dylan.
Hey everybody.
This episode is brought to you by Harvey Watt. Harvey Watt Insurance is the largest provider of loss of medical insurance. Check it out at harveywatt.com. It's probably a lot more affordable than you might think. Speaking of that, we get an update from our friend Clint about his current medical loss situation.
Yeah, back in episode 11, we spoke with Clint, and he had an uncommon heart condition that caused him to lose his medical unexpectedly, and he shared his story. So if you haven't heard that, check out that interview, and we're going to give him a call right now and get an update.
We just want to check in with Clint, get an update. So Clint, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. How are you guys?
Wonderful.
Outstanding. What updates do you have for us, dude?
Well, the good news is that I got my medical back.
Woohoo!
Yeah. Yeah. I guess after the last time we talked, I was in that 90-day waiting period, trying to get ready to do all of my testing. And on October 8th was when my 90 days from my procedure, which was what the FAA required me to wait after an ablation, was 90 days. I was in Disneyland on that day with my son. So I wasn't able to get the testing done until I came back from there. And then that next week was just kind of nuts. I did a 2D or I guess a 3D echocardiogram, which was no big deal. And then I wore a Holter monitor for 24 hours. I then had to do a thyroid test, which that's just a blood draw. So that was no big deal either. And then I had to do a nuclear test with a stress test. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but that's a ball of fun.
Is that where there's like a nuclear countdown and you have to make a decision at the last second on like 5, 4, 3?
Yeah, similar. Yeah, I had my hand over the red button and I had to
right. The key around your neck.
Exactly. Yeah, well, and me and the other guy had to twist the keys at the right. exact yeah. same time.
It is a complicated test, yeah. So I'm glad you passed that.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Very relevant.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, nuclear tests, if you ever have to do one, I'll just kind of put that out there since we're talking the medical stuff. They're not bad. It's just it's a long day because the one that I had to do, you go in, you have an IV put into your body, and then you have actual radioactive chemicals put inside of you. Then you basically do three different heart tests on that. But the good news is on all the tests I did, everything came back normal. In fact, I was given a pretty clean bill of health. So with all that information, I was able to then schedule an appointment with an FAA medical examiner in the Phoenix area. And then that's kind of where, and this is something that everybody should know that goes through this medical stuff, is you're your own advocate. Everybody else is there to do their jobs. However, a lot of things fell through the cracks. So I ended up getting all my testing done and was told I would have all my documentation by the end of that first week, right after I came back with my son from our trip.
Uh-huh.
And at the end of that first week, I still did not have my Holter monitor results, and I still did not have my nuclear test results. They had them, just nobody had reviewed them.
Ooh.
And so I asked for them to expedite that. And of course, that was not the FAA medical examiner's office. That was my cardiologist's office. And by Friday afternoon of that week, when I was supposed to be in Phoenix, I was still where I live. And those tests never got documented. So I had to cancel my first week with my FAA medical examiner. Rescheduled for the next Friday. And comes all the way around to the next Thursday, and I had been on the phone at least 10 times with the cardiologist's office to get all my paperwork in order. And at 5 o'clock on Thursday, they finally said, we have everything. So we're talking now, you know, close to 10 days after I was supposed, or I'm sorry, after I started my testing and was told it was going to be done in 5. I got all the paperwork, drive down to Phoenix, and you guys will enjoy this story. Where I live is approximately 2 hours from my medical examiner's office. So I drive down to his office, bring all the paperwork in. He does the normal medical exam on me, starts going through the paperwork, and determines that I don't have everything he needs. And one of them was actually 3D imagery of my nuclear test, which is on a CD.
Oh.
And I said, well, can I have them fax this to you? Can they do the pictures? He said, no, I need all this information, hard copy. So at this point, I'm realizing that I'm not going to get my medical that day because he can't submit the information to the FAA. So I take it upon myself and drive back up to where I live 2 hours away and get all the necessary paperwork in order that they forgot to put in and then drive back down to Phoenix.
Wait, did you have it at your house or you had to go back to the doctor?
I had to go back to the doctor's office. I had to pull a bunch of, while I'm driving back to where I live, I was on the phone the entire way with the radiologist's office, getting the 3D imagery, with the doctor's office, making sure. And they were telling me that they couldn't give me what I was asking for because they don't normally supply that. So ended up, luckily, I got a hold of somebody at the hospital and they were a manager and they printed off what I needed.
Wow.
So yeah, I picked it all back up and then turned around and drove all the way back down to Phoenix and dropped it off before my doctor's office closed.
Long day.
So really, the moral of the story here is you can have all these different advocacy organizations and everything else, but you really have to be the one that's on top of all the paperwork and really cracking the whip, huh?
Yeah, 100% agree with that. My union did a very good job of making sure I had all the paperwork in order. And they were the ones, to be honest with you, I knew before my doctor knew that I didn't have all the paperwork because my union called me back. I had sent them copies of everything I had originally received. And they said, you're missing this and this. You're going to have to get it. So it was frustrating because I was trying to squeeze this all in and get it done as fast as possible. But at the end of the day, it's over with. I've got my medical back and I am been enjoying some time off. Luckily with my company, one of the better things is once you're cleared to go back to work, they put me back on full-time pay and I've been awaiting training since then. And I just got a call yesterday that I'm going back to training on December 3rd. So I will be fully back and in the saddle again on December 3rd.
So the skies are no longer safe for holiday travel.
Because Clint will be out there.
He won't be done with training by then.
Yeah, right.
No, my training actually, so that's another thing that's kind of funny. After all this got completed, you know, the airline was really quick when I told them, hey, something's wrong. I have this heart problem. And they pulled me offline immediately. And then within 60 days of that, they're like, send back all your documents from the company, send back your ID. And I did all of that. I followed what they wanted. Well, when I called them and said, hey, I'm cleared to come back, it's funny that it doesn't work as fast.
To get all your stuff back.
Yeah. I still
they're like, who is this? New phone. Lost this number. Who is this?
Yeah, what's your name?
Yeah, exactly. Who dis? so I still do not have my paperwork, my documents from the company, which we all have on our iPad. I've talked to the group that works on that at my airline, and they told me 10 to 15 more business days.
Jeez.
Wait, so do you even have an iPad right now?
No.
Have they assigned you at-home study for training?
Yes, which I can't do.
That's okay. Awesome. If any of our listeners have an iPad they'd like to donate to Clint's 787 study program.
Well, they had a solution for that. They said, well, just come down to the office in Dallas and pick one up. And I live in Arizona. Well, then go to the Phoenix chief pilot's office and pick one up, which I could do, except I can't get access to the chief pilot's office without my ID, which they still have. So, yeah, it was kind of a cluster.
So
there
now you're meeting the chief pilot at Denny's on...
yeah. We'll see you at the Circle K.
Well, the good news is that they were able to get my identification back to me finally. And I'm cleared to travel again and jump seat and all that. So that's good. And I should have my iPad before I go to training.
Listen.
And I've already talked with the standards department at my airline, and they said, whatever, just when you get here, we'll figure out what you need to do.
They were already going to put you in a special class anyways, yeah, probably in the corner.
Well, so okay, so that's another aspect.
Here's your this helmet.
Here are these blocks. Can you stack these?
Well, it's funny because the entire time I was communicating with the train department during my time out and trying to get back, I was told, oh, we're going to put you through a special short course because you've been out for so long.
And we've got a special short bus for you to ride.
A special short bus to the short course.
Yes, exactly. Well, you guys know how I am, so that's pretty fitting. Where I will go in for 2 days of ground school, and it looks like I'm going to be by myself, which will probably be beneficial. I'll just be in with an instructor and go over systems and flows and procedures, and then I'll have 3 simulator sessions and then a check ride. So I'll have time to kind of get, you know, everything reoriented and remember stuff. So it's all good. Everything's good. To be quite honest with you guys, I've been on cloud 9 for at least, you know, the last 3 weeks. And I basically have been able to have the entire month of November off, spending time with my family, knowing I have my job back, knowing I'm back on full pay. And then now finding out I'm going to training in December. So I'm going to be home for Thanksgiving, which will probably be the last time I am for many years.
Enjoy it. Well, that's awesome though, Clint. I think at the end of the day, your story was so powerful. We received so much feedback from our listeners just because it was so real, and it really brought the reality of things that can happen to anybody at any time.
Yep. Could happen to you.
Yeah.
Could happen to anybody.
So thank you so much for sharing that story. I'm so happy that it's got a positive ending and you're back to work. That's great. And it just really highlights to everybody the importance of protecting yourself, being aware of the process, staying on top of paperwork. And at the end of the day, you got to be the one driving the ship there.
Yeah, you're correct in all that. It has been a learning experience for sure. I hope I never have to go through it again. But at the same time, you know, now I have some experience and I can help others who are maybe going through this, all phases of it, from when you go out to when you get back. So I am, you know, trying to take some positive out of the whole thing. That will be, you know, something I can carry with me the rest of my career. But the other thing is, you know, after we talked last time, I didn't even think about it until one of our friends I was speaking with reminded me that now that I'm back at work, I have no vacation and no sick time left.
Oh, right.
So if anything were to happen to me, let's not get dramatic and say my heart issue comes back. Let's just say I cut the tip of my finger off, which I recently did. Luckily, it wasn't bad enough where I needed any medical attention. But let's say you have something stupid like that happen, or you roll your ankle and break it, and you're going to be out 6 weeks. If something were to happen to me right now, I have nothing. Because it would restart all the 90-day clocks with long-term disability and short-term disability.
Yeah. Wow, you're pretty vulnerable then right now.
Yeah, exactly. So I have to take my own advice, and it's advice I want to give to other people. If you're ever in a medical situation and coming out of a medical situation, yeah, it's very precarious. And I have to get myself covered with some insurance right away. So that's one of the things I've been working on, is what kind of insurance can I get right now in case something happens to me right now. And now that I've been through it, you know, I think I'm going to be pretty loaded up on insurance for the rest of my life.
Well, I'm glad it was just the tip, Clint.
Yeah, it was just the tip. Do you want to know? Okay.
I don't think we do.
Yeah, I think we're good. Fast. You're breaking up, Clint.
What were you going to say?
I was going to tell you guys the stupidity of it. So, you guys know this. I actually cut the tip of my finger off cutting celery for my son's lunch with a knife like a month and a half ago, and that wasn't a big deal. But then 2 weeks ago, I have an automatic closing hinge downstairs on my garage door, which is it's a double door, and they're both heavy metal doors. And I was bringing in Christmas decorations for my wife. So this is the stuff that can happen. Bringing in Christmas decorations for my wife, and one of the double doors closed against the other one, and my finger was sitting right there and cut the tip of it off. So be careful out there.
You know, I mean, we laugh about it, but at the end of the day, like, it is serious. And that's why we have forged a relationship with Harvey Watt because we think it's important, you know, the types of insurance and protecting yourself. Those are the kind of things that I think raising awareness, like your stories, it's important. You just never know what's going to happen.
And insurance is just like lawyers. It's the furthest thing from your mind, it seems so unimportant until you need one. Then all of a sudden it's the most important thing in the world. So you were a good testament to that, Clint. We appreciate you being forthcoming, sharing your story. And I think you most certainly probably helped somebody out there.
Yeah, and I think all of the listeners would join us in saying welcome back to the skies. We're really happy for you, and fly safe out there, man. If you see a Dreamliner, you know, doing two or three bounces on the landing,
that's Clint on OE.
Might be Clint on OE.
Yeah, that's probably going to be me. I'm a little amazed that the next time I fly an airplane, because they just told me operating experience has to be like 30 hours, and they're going to do that in one trip to China. So the last time I flew an airplane was from the Salt Lake area down to the Phoenix area. And the next time I'm going all the way to China. So
that's good. You can get all your bounces out of sight.
Yeah.
Get it out of the world.
Get all that, your knockoff Rolexes, everything. Just one fell swoop.
Yeah. It'd be great. Good. All right, Clint. Thanks for the call, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, gentlemen. All right. Have a wonderful day.
Later, man. All right. See ya.
Bye-bye.
Well, the good news for Clint is that was a happy ending to his story, but I think it was really eye-opening for all of us to hear about the trials, tribulations, and I think most of all, the bureaucracy that's involved with losing your medical. It's something that just, it takes forever for the whole process to go through. I think that's what I learned.
Yeah, absolutely. And even something as minor as getting a precancerous mole taken out at the dermatologist can put you in this exact same bureaucratic process. And that's why it's so important, like we said before, to have somebody you can call, whether that's your union's aeromedical advisory board or the guys at Harvey Watt. But if you have anything done to your body by anybody, it behooves you to get it reviewed by the advisory committee or board or whoever you have, whatever resources you have available to you before you show up to the AME. Clint obviously was more of a fast moving situation that ended up in the ER. But I tell you what, I don't make my dermatologist appointments in the middle of my medical cycle. So I have months to deal with any sort of funny business or anything else, you know, or even my annual checkups with blood work and everything, because there are certain things like a precancerous mole does not necessarily require you to self ground yourself.
Yeah.
But it can end up with you being grounded when it gets deferred to the FAA and then you wait 3 months. That happened to one of our buddies.
Yeah. Especially the older we get, the more strategy there is. It's not like when we were 21.
You know, it's crazy. I flew with a guy the other day. He's in his early 60s and he's a healthy guy, works out, you know, fit. And he went to the doctor for his checkup and he goes, you know, he just wanted to get his heart checked out. Like he has no problems, no symptoms. Mm-hmm. And the guy wrote him a referral to go to the cardiologist and get a stress test and everything. He did the thing, you know, on the treadmill and the whole deal. His heart checked out totally fine. And I was talking to him about this stuff. I said, if I were you, I would call, you know, I told him about the benefit that we have with Harvey Watt and you can call the aeromedical advisory guys. I said, I would just make a phone call because you were required to disclose any visits to a doctor in the last 3 years. So you're going to have to disclose you went to the cardiologist. And on the surface, most people don't go to the cardiologist just for a checkup. I'm like, so before you go in and disclose that to the AME, you may want to ask these guys and see what maybe paperwork you need to bring in to accompany this statement on your MedExpress or whatever. But it was just one of those things. This whole medical series we've done has really changed my outlook. And the biggest takeaway is you have to have a strategy to managing your medical certificate.
Absolutely.
And I told a guy, I'm like, look, you could get this deferred to the FAA. You could be out of work. Your benefit is X. You make X a month. I go, this could cost you over $100,000 in like that. So it might be worth the 10-minute phone call on your 20 days off this month. You could probably find time between rounds of golf to fit that in. So
I'm sure he was so receptive to that message.
No, he was laughing because I was like, he knew it's true. And he's like, well, that's a good idea. So
yeah.
Anyway. Yeah.
Well, it just reinforces why we have partnered with Harvey Watt. Just bringing all of this awareness to pilots, it's a big deal. And like I said, the older you get, the more this should be at the forefront of what you think about.
Patreon card.
To set up this next segment, we've got Jamie Stember on the line with us. Jamie is the chairman of the CAM Governing Board, which is part of the NBAA leadership. So welcome to the program today, Jamie.
Thanks, Dylan.
Jamie, could you quickly just explain what the CAM program is all about and your role on the governing board?
Sure. The CAM program is NBAA's brainchild that happened back in the early 2000s, and they were looking for a way to certify aviation managers and their capabilities to run flight departments. And they basically comprised it into five domains and said, if you're competent in these domains, then we feel that we can certify that you have the talent to run a flight department. Those domains are leadership and human resources, operations, aircraft maintenance and facilities, and business management. The CAM program is the only accredited certification in business aviation today.
Yeah, obviously there's a lot more information about that program that we'll have posted, but you do training, you do courses, there's an examination. I mean, this isn't something you can just send away for and get overnight, right?
No, there is an application that you have to fill out, and the application is divided into five areas. There's employment history, formal education, point qualification systems, letters of recommendation, and then there's a payment of $100 that you have to do. It's vetted. You need 100 points in all five areas, and then you're able to take the exam. It's probably a 6-month process.
Oh, okay.
And Certified Aviation Manager Program is an opportunity for future leaders to earn an accreditation certifying that they are able to lead flight departments in the future. It's important because it's all about lifelong learning. And the NBAA, in their infinite wisdom, saw a need for this. And they made huge strides and given us incredible latitudes to make this a reality. Now there are over 500 certified aviation managers, and we're just excited to see what the next 10 years bring.
Well, I think that lifelong quest in learning is a great point, and that kind of leads us to this luncheon that you guys had at the NBAA base conference in Las Vegas in October. We got connected through James O'Neill, who you had invited to speak at that event, and we were honored that you allowed us to come and participate and record that and kind of capture some of the information. And quite frankly, listening to it, it was so good, and there was so much information that Max and I thought, you know what, this is something that we think we would love to distribute to our listeners, because this is a really hot topic in business aviation right now. You had James come and talk about retention and recruitment in flight departments. And I think we don't need to tell our listeners that right now, this is what's going on. A lot of people are leaving business aviation to go work at the airlines. There's a lot that should go into that decision. And James touches a lot about that. Can you talk a little bit about what your goals were for that luncheon?
Yeah, great question. So we wanted to gather all the CAMs that were in attendance at base. We do that every year. And we try to do things that are a little dynamic and up to date and challenge their thinking and their leadership. And what an opportunity we had this year to have James come in and put some color on what's exactly happening out there. He sees this on a day-to-day basis. We have our own internal struggles. So to hear him help us do that was very valuable. And I think your listeners are going to have an ability to capture what we talked about that day. We're not here to say that we're the experts in this. It was just a discussion that we had. It was fruitful. It was great dialogue. And to your point, it was great that 21.5 was there to be able to capture this and understand how important it is to the industry to broadcast it.
Yeah, it's really difficult to get a bunch of department managers in the room. I think that was a very unique opportunity to do that. And really, we got a chance to hear about the thoughts of department managers on recruitment, retention, talent acquisition. It was a unique opportunity. So thank you for letting us be a part of it. We're going to air that recap right now. Jamie's going to stick around. James and Max are going to join us for that. If you want more information about the NBAA CAM program, we will have information in the show notes. Just scroll down and there'll be links. So here we go.
So today we have Jamie Stember, who's the chairman of the CAM governing board, and also our friend James O'Neill from Raven Careers, who was there speaking at the event, and Dylan and I, and we're just going to kind of recap it and go from there. So I guess we'll start with you, James. What did you take away from the discussion?
Sure. So the first thing is I want to thank Jamie and the CAM board for having us out. You know, they were super generous with letting us record and letting us kind of have some of these conversations before and after. But during the event, you know, it's always really unique when you have everybody in a room face to face. And that's what I think kind of some of the advantages of some of these events are, is you have a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds bringing up the different pain points and successes that they're sharing within their organization. And there were really five takeaways that I picked up on through both the questions that people were asking, but also kind of some of the expression of frustration and success. And, you know, I think if any flight department could narrow their focus down to just, you know, one, maybe two of these five items, they would see some pretty significant changes in terms of moving in the direction that they want to head towards. So the first thing that popped up, and this popped up over and over and over again in a couple of different ways, is the fact that the executives, the pilots, and human resources are all speaking a different language. And there's a lot of times where it's almost like people are talking past each other or talking at each other versus communicating.
Right. The thing we kept hearing was, well, how do you get the principal or how do you get human resources to understand what time off means or how we actually get paid? How do you get somebody to understand? I remember hearing that a bunch of times.
Yeah. And what a lot of the palpable struggle that I saw was, you know, when you're a pilot, you're not going to get an executive to think like a pilot, right? So we can't control how they think, but we can control how we start to adjust our language and learn how to communicate in a way that they can understand. The second big topic that popped up over and over and over was the fact that departments are struggling with a lack of consensus of what they have that's working well and what they want improvement on, specifically due to differences in the generational groups, right? So folks that may be in their 20s working with folks in their 30s or 40s who are working with folks in their, you know, 50s, 60s, and even sometimes 70s, right? Those different generational experiences create very different perspectives on what is good and what is not good within a flight department. And that lack of consensus is really making it difficult for flight departments to navigate to a point where really everybody is content and happy with their job.
Yeah.
The third one, and this kind of piggybacks off the second with the lack of consensus, is there is no clear standard on scheduling, pay, quality of life, and retirement. And there was one gentleman in particular that asked a very direct question, which was, look, what trends are we seeing regionally? And is there some type of standard that could be applied based on that? And the reality is a lot of this is all over the map. You know, I was just having a conversation with someone here about an hour ago regarding some salary negotiation information. And we were talking about differences in pay on fleet sizes. And I was explaining how two different individuals in the same market, one flying a Phenom 300, one flying a Challenger 300, both PICs, both Part 91, and the Phenom 300 guy is making $15,000 more than the Challenger 300 guy.
Hmm.
And neither of them are aware of each other or aware of what trade-offs are they making in terms of scheduling, pay, quality of life, and retirement. You know, depending on what those trade-offs are, that salary differential can be completely acceptable. But this lack of standard and lack of awareness, right, is creating a certain amount of discomfort amongst the group.
Yeah, I mean, how do you solve that? because do you do it regionally? I mean, the airplane isn't, a Challenger 300 isn't any cheaper if you buy it in New York or if you buy it in Louisiana, you know? So do you actually tailor it to the geographic region, which I know in the salary surveys and stuff, they do have geographic information, or is everybody trying to make some sort of standard across the board? That's a tough problem.
Yeah. So that's a really good question. And I think one of the things that is creating the most amount of confusion amongst pilots, while a percentage of pilot pay is based on what their skills and abilities are, a certain amount of their pay is based on proximity to other competitive jobs.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you live in Montana, for instance, and you love where you live and you want to have time spending where you live, and there's not a lot of other competitive flight departments in your market, you are not going to be able, you are not going to have as much leverage in a negotiation as somebody in, let's say, Chicago, New York, or LA, who has a lot of opportunities in both corporate aviation and the airline in terms of what they can consider in scheduling, pay, quality of life, retirement, type of flying, advancement opportunities, and so on and so forth.
But even then, I mean, do you categorize it by state or by the Northwest and the Southwest, or what? Because Montana is a lot different than Seattle, you know? And so it's just, I don't know.
That's a tough one.
It is. I think one of the most difficult concepts to communicate with people in the situation is it doesn't matter where you live. So a lot of pilots focus on, well, I live here, so it costs more. And I understand that. But when you're walking into a negotiation, where you live doesn't matter as much as how much leverage you have does.
Right.
So the reason why someone in, let's say, LA, for example, can typically, right, for a same size aircraft in another Midwestern market, command a higher salary is not because LA costs more to live in. It's because there are more jobs in LA to get. You know, you can take a look at different regional areas inside the state of California that are very expensive, that have very different approaches to compensation.
Right. And you've seen even flight departments in the Bay allow guys to commute now because it's hard to get somebody to come live in that market because of the cost of housing and not pay them, you know, several hundred thousand dollars a year.
Yeah. And the Bay Area is a really good example where, you know, we get some frequent feedback from pilots about how, you know, look, the total compensation, right? We take everything put together, just isn't adequate. I don't think anybody on the face of the earth would argue that the San Francisco Bay Area is affordable to live in. So when we take a look at, well, why are they having struggles, right? It boils down to leverage.
I think one of the great things about business aviation, corporate aviation in general, is it's never about one size fits all. I think if we look at the airlines, the four of us can count on two hands odds of flying a particular type, make, and model of airplane, right? I mean, there's only roughly 10, Boeing, Airbus, and then we can drill down from there. With business aviation, you're talking about something from a Cessna 414 to a G650 to a different part of the country, to this part of the country. I think to your point, James, which is very valid, it's about leverage and where you are, not only geographically. We're not comparing apples to apples, unfortunately. And since this industry is just so diverse in what the jobs require, I don't think we're ever going to see the day where we're going to pay somebody a set amount of money to fly Global Express versus the gent who's flying the Cessna 414. We can't put ourselves in a box like that, like the airlines can, just because we have much more of a dynamic environment.
Yeah. And you have to be careful what you wish for too, because if say all the pilots get together and like, you know, we're putting our foot down here and we're going to set up a guild and these are the standard pay rates in this, that's going to drive some people away from business aviation, which is not good for pilots, period. So sometimes you got to be a little bit careful. And a good example of that, once again, is the airlines, where pilots have gone a little bit too far in instances and then had to take pay cuts later on, you know, to restore the balance of the balance sheet and things like that. So it's going to be a problem. We've been talking about it for years. I don't know that there's a real solution besides kind of letting the free market determine what pay is worth. Because again, in those small markets in Montana or whatever, yeah, it's one thing. There's no, not a bunch of other jobs and competition and places you can go. But on the flip side of that, the owner or operator of the airplane doesn't have a big pool of pilots that live in Missoula, Montana that he can replace you with. So it's, you also are more valuable in a certain sense in that market too.
Yeah. And I had a thought too on the transparency side. You know, as we look at the airlines, obviously you can go on the web and find the pay rates and a lot of the information about the contract and compensation really easily. Business aviation, much more difficult. Obviously, NBAA and your team, Jamie, have worked to increase the quality of the salary survey. I know you guys have the new geography corrections. But James, do you think there is an advantage to more transparency with corporate flight departments sharing compensation information?
Yeah, so that's actually a perfect segue, because my fourth takeaway was actually about a lack of transparency and how it's hurting business aviation. So, you know, we were doing a coaching session with someone a few weeks ago, and they were a corporate pilot who made a decision to go into the airlines and is now debating on going back into corporate aviation. And so, you know, we were discussing that because this is a pretty major life decision for them. The feedback that they're getting from everyone is, hey, you know, the airlines are where it's at. It's stable. There's better pay, better retirement, so on and so forth. But he's miserable. We started to drill down, and we were able to identify that there were really two main areas that were important to him. And those were schedule and quality of life. He has, you know, younger children, and being at events on the weekends, you know, specifically community events on Sunday, are a big deal for him and his family. And so we played out a scenario where I said, okay, so, you know, you're making $100,000 a year, you're home this many days a month, because, you know, we were going through what his current, you know, quality of life is, you know, mm-hmm. six-figure income, you know, this is how many days you're home, this is how many days you're traveling. And I said, okay, now I want you to take those numbers, right? I want you to keep all of the days on the road and so on and so forth. But I want you to take your pay and I want you to increase it from $100,000 to $400,000 a year. I said, are you going to be happy? And he goes, no, not at all. And it kind of hit him like a ton of bricks. It's like, oh man, I'm chasing after this unicorn that when he achieves it, won't, it's not going to bring him the happiness that he's thinking. Now, interestingly enough, we drilled down a little bit further from there. And when we got into some of the quality of life stuff, turns out backside of the clock flying wasn't really of interest. So we started talking about, okay, well, do you want to do wide body flying? Well, yeah. Okay. Well, most of those wide bodies fly at night. So, and it wasn't not like a sarcastic thing. It just, you'd be surprised how many people don't put that information together. So now we have to go back to those pay tables and we have to drop off a significant amount, because unless you are willing to accept that quality of life, you're never going to make that money or hold that type schedule. Now, on the other hand, we were able to take a look at a couple of local corporate operators where he was able to basically speak with some of the pilots and to a pretty high degree of accuracy, learn how often and when those airplanes are flying. And it met all of his quality of life standards to a T. Now, interestingly enough, one or two of the departments did not meet his financial needs, but another one definitely did, and they're very interested in him. So he's now in a position where he at least has the information to arm himself to make a decision in terms of what's right for him and his family. And because outside of the cockpit stuff really is important to him, specifically some of the business opportunities he takes advantage of, some of the opportunities he takes advantage of in his community, it's likely that he's going to shift back into corporate aviation. Now, he likely would not have been able to come to that decision on his own because of that lack of transparency. We were able to aggregate a lot of information from clients that we've worked with over the year and pull back the curtain and go, here's what this picture actually looks like, right? Where we were able to take information and data and aggregate it and provide the same level of information that you can get on the internet about what you're going to get if you go to FedEx, Delta, American, so on and so forth. And that's the role that we serve in this industry as Raven Career Development, is to help individuals, you know, get more access to transparent information. But if I'm running a corporate flight department, my main mission is to pull back that curtain as far as possible, because it's now hurting me, if that makes sense.
Well, I guess depending on your operation too, if you only fly Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays, then having a little bit of secrecy, but you make a good point. And that maybe there's some sort of standard job posting questionnaire where you could say, you know, obviously salary and the big things that are easy, but 401k contribution, hard days off per month, typical schedule, you know, all of that stuff would be really interesting and kind of weeding through things for a person like you're discussing that has very specific requirements.
So when you just made the comment about the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, you may not want to be transparent. So using my own personal life as an example, I don't have children. And so Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday are just days of the week to me. I specifically negotiated with a company in early, like 2010, 2011. I specifically negotiated to have Tuesday, Wednesday off. I wanted to work the weekend because it worked with some other scheduling needs that I had in my family at the time. And so you'd be surprised that even if you were only going to work someone Friday, Saturday, Sunday, there is somebody out there that would kill for that schedule. But if you're not transparent about it, you spend all this time recruiting and interviewing people that it's just not going to be a good fit for.
Hmm. Jamie, you had kind of told an interesting story at the luncheon about your personal decision. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. You know, I was with American Airlines at the turn of the, 2000 to about 2004. And for me, it was more about the intangibles, Dylan. And, you know, I was doing things that were just shaking my moral compass. I think I gave the example, I called in sick in a 5-year span, like 36 or 37 times. And, you know, here we are 20 years later. Was I sick? No. It was just an inconvenience to go to work because I had to commute and I had to do all these other things. And the third rail of the airline world is commuting. And it drove me into moral decisions that I wasn't happy with. And you know, after the last 15 years, I've been sick one time, legitimately sick, where I could not fly. So that just shook me a little bit, you know, from a personal standpoint. And I think business aviation, no matter what the discipline is, I think business aviation offers a lot of intangibles, and we sacrifice the tangibles, i.e. the knowing the job security, the 401k contribution, the known salary for type of equipment or position that you hold. I think you have to look hard in the mirror and figure out what's most important to you. And if the intangibles outweigh the tangibles, then you can point yourself in a direction.
You know, what's tough about that is unless you've flown in business aviation, I think that's hard to explain to people that haven't.
Yeah.
And I know, like, having done it, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I miss that stuff every day. Well, at least every day I'm at work. But
so are we doing a bad job then as an industry
I don't think so. It's just the problem is that stuff is really hard to put on paper, and it varies so wildly between different jobs in business aviation, but it is such an important part of the drive, you know, and the job satisfaction of business aviation. That's a hard thing to put to young people that are coming up to say, hey, I want to be an airline pilot, or I want to be a corporate pilot. Those are hard things unless you have somebody that's currently flying and they can kind of explain it to you over time and get a lot of the perks that come with flying business jets and what your time on the road is like compared to, you know, a 4-day trip at the airlines is wildly different than a 4-day trip at a Part 91 flight department, but not necessarily so different from a 135, you know, one-way charter operation. So there's just so much. There's so many things that are just difficult to quantify.
Well, I think backpacking onto that, you have to know yourself a little bit too. I think the airline path is so easy because it's so easy to just look at the pay rates and look at those kinds of things and say, well, it's the higher compensation, so it's the best decision. But if you don't have some introspection and understanding your value, back to your point, James, about what's actually important to you, and that's a really hard thing to suss out when you're maybe 24 and you're making that decision, you may not really have all of those factors aligned. So, you know, I'm kind of in a similar boat as Jamie. I used to fly at the airlines and I'm at a Part 91 flight department now. And of course, I could be making more money somewhere else. But to me, it's some of the intangibles and the schedule and some of those other things that I have found personally are just much more valuable. So there's a cost associated with that. And I don't know that 23 or 25-year-old Dylan would have been able to make that same decision.
No, and I think a point to attest to that whole situation is I've been flying for the major airline now for almost 6 months, and I already have authorization from the VP of Flight Ops to go do outside flying so I can go fly Gulfstreams again.
Let me float something by you then. I think the rubber could really meet the road here over the next, let's call it 2, 3, 4 years. We're definitely not economists here, but let's say the economy craters and we get back into a, you know, mid-2000s or early 2000s arena where the airlines start to really pinch and they start to have to furlough. What happens now with the pilot shortage? Do the airlines disservice this problem with debt because they can't afford to lose bodies anymore? Or do they let the attrition happen naturally and lose what little talent is really out there back into private sector, corporate aviation, wherever they may go? What's the next shoe that's going to fall looking ahead 3, 4, 5 years that's going to tell us a lot about our industry?
So interestingly enough, each one of you told a story that kind of touched on the same point that I think addresses some, how does this get handled 5 years down the road? Caveat, my crystal ball is in the shop. So, you know, I don't know how accurate this prog is going to be, but so many of the pilots in the room brought this point up over and over and over, which is the struggle between data and emotion driving decision making. And it feels comfortable to say that you know, I am data driven, right? Because it's tangible, we can hold on to it, we can touch it, feel it, see it, right? But the reality of the situation is we make decisions emotionally. And that's really the fifth takeaway that I got from the event, was watching people struggle with exactly what each of the three of you just brought up, which is, how do I reconcile the difference between this data over here, which is mainly centered around financial, right? Paired with the fact that the emotional side, which is, I'm not happy, I'm not getting what I want, or I'm getting what I want and I don't want to leave it, but there's this financial reason to do that. And you would think that that would really only, you know, you would think that someone in their 20s would struggle with that more than someone in their 30s, 40s, or 50s. We have just as many clients in their 50s and 60s struggling with those exact same points as we do in their 20s and 30s. And the reason for that is because the environment around us is always changing. And there are salary surveys out there. Right. We can go onto a number of different websites and pull up contracts, and I can tell you exactly how many days a month you're going to, you know, the contract says you're going to work and so on and so forth. But there is no survey for how happy your kid is that you're there to coach T-ball. Right. There's no survey for your spouse had the flu and you were able to be home and actually clean and cook and cut up peanut butter and jelly sandwiches into triangles. Right. There's no survey for what it's like to be able to do 3 nights out at some location where you get to have a lot of fun and go out to eat at some really nice restaurants that you enjoy, and so on and so forth. And there aren't ever really going to be surveys for that. So there's this constant tension between what's going to happen in the future, right? Which is that financial aspect, right? Am I going to have enough for retirement? Am I going to have enough pay? Am I going to be out of work, right? There's that future stuff. But then there's a day-to-day right now, which is this, man, I am either miserable in this march towards that future destination that I don't know where it is or what it's going to look like, or this like, hey, you know what? I really like what I'm doing on a day-by-day basis, and I can't emotionally reconcile giving that up for money. And there were a number of people in the room struggling with that. And it constantly comes back to salary surveys, but ultimately the decision is being made based on, I like living where I live and I don't want to commute, right? Or I like the fact that I get to go to work and see the same 3 people all the time, so I get to know them on a deeper level and do things together and have fun and so on and so forth. And those two are never going to reconcile out in a traditional way that pilots try and go about doing this, which is surveys. It really is a pretty deep dive into figuring out what are your actual drivers, where do you have leverage, and how do you start negotiating for the things that are actually important.
And jumping off on the things that are actually important, you know, I can't remember who said it at the luncheon, but they said, look, we don't need, for the people in business aviation, it's not like we need to make $300,000, right? Maybe, yes, there is probably some increase in pay that could happen. But for most people, a lot of it is schedule related. And we talked about that a little bit during the lunch about how are ways that you can talk to management about understanding time off. Do you remember a little bit about that, James?
Yeah. You know, it's, and that goes back to that lack of consensus in terms of what someone defines as a good or a bad schedule. There are people that will take flexibility in their scheduling, meaning that they don't, you know, for example, people don't ever know when they're going to fly, but on average, they're only flying 7 days a month. They're completely fine with that. Other people, if they only fly 7 days a month or even 3 days a month, but they didn't know that 2 or 3 weeks in advance, right? It just destroys their family life. And that is really hard to start to figure out when, A, there's no transparency in the process in terms of when you're hiring somebody. Hey, look, what are we, you know, what is this realistically going to look like? And then number two, there's no consensus in the flight department as to whether or not that's okay or good or bad. It makes it really tough because there is, once again, it goes back to kind of that survey mentality. You need someone to facilitate getting into a room and hammering that out, because there's no Excel spreadsheet that's going to give you that answer.
And you can't, like, to your point, you can't just say how many days off on average we expect. Well, days off and days off that you choose are completely different days off, you know, so you have to quantify it further even than just plain days off.
Well, and when we had folks in the room that had more of a, you know, HR background, that was, you know, kind of the things that we talked about is how many people walk into HR and they go, well, you only worked 8 days last month. And you're going, well, yeah, I worked 8 days, but I was on call for 25 of them, which means it's basically house arrest, right? You know, yeah. you can't go on, you can't leave, right? You can't, you know, I always, one of my secrets that I use for folks when they go into an interview, when they're asking department managers in terms of what the on-call schedule is like, a lot of times they'll get very unclear answers. And so what I advise them to do is ask the aviation director, if I wake up at 2 p.m., you know, if I get up at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday and crack open a beer, do I have to call you before I take a sip? And you can usually see pretty quickly, right? If the person starts squirming in their seat, you're on call, right? You know, same thing. You know, hey, if on a Tuesday at 9 a.m. I wake up and, you know, my spouse and kids decide that they want to go on a 4-hour drive out in, you know, to a national park and we want to go hike where there's no cell coverage for 3 or 4 hours, do I have to call you and tell you I'm doing that, or can I just go do it? Because at a corporate flight department that has clarity in scheduling and at an airline that has clarity in scheduling, when you're off, you don't have to call anybody, right? You are expected to show up at your duty on time, right? Ready to go to work, so on and so forth. But if they tell you have off Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you want to go hike or camp at some place that has no cell coverage, fine, knock yourself out. And once again, there's a lot of ways to start to ask questions to quantify this and figure out who are we currently as a flight department, and who is that okay with and not okay with? Because if the fundamental nature of the flight department is we have a very low volume of trips, but they are on call, and your lifestyle does not support on call, it's really going to be miserable.
Yeah. And again, some people that just like to stay at home and tinker in their garage and do that thing, they don't care, you know? So you're right. You just have to have the information to be able to find the right fit for that particular job. And I think that's kind of where the transparency thing comes in, and it's beneficial for everybody. So you know what you're getting into as the pilot, and the company or the owner or whoever knows that they're getting somebody that's a good fit for that position.
Yeah. And every time as an aviation director, you hire someone that's not a good fit, depending on the training cost, that's $50,000 to $75,000. And there's really only so many times you can get that wrong before it really starts to harm the flight department. And it starts to harm other financial aspects of the flight department in terms of what people are getting paid, because you have this revolving door. So getting good as a flight department, or getting clear as a flight department, in terms of who are we, what are we offering, and who is that a benefit to, makes a world of difference in these conversations. Because at least if you have a bunch of people in the flight department that define happiness, good, bad, however you want to frame it, as the same thing or similar thing, it's a lot easier. When you have 10 people in a flight department and 3 people are going pay, 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 and 7 people are going quality of life, quality of life, quality of life, and the ultimate decision is to split the baby and give poor quality of life and poor pay, because, you know, they're raising the pay enough that the people, you know, that certain people are happy, and they're raising the quality of life so that certain people are happy, but it's never really in line with what anybody wants. You start to have a lot of discontent and a lot of turmoil inside the department. You know, and the gentleman that I referenced the conversation I had with a few weeks ago, we flat out asked him, if you could make $400,000 a year doing exactly what you're doing, would you do it? And he said, absolutely no. Not everybody is driven by that top end financial aspect. And there is some financial threshold that he has to meet to be happy. And that's really where that magic happens, is figuring out what those thresholds are for each individual. And then aligning your department around that to recruit and retain them.
James, one other thing we talked a little bit about during the luncheon was recruitment versus retention. And I think you guys had some interesting points. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So that conversation was pretty broad, but we went through kind of the history of what's happened since, you know, 2000 through today, that's led to some of the reasons on why recruitment and retention is handled the way it is today. But ultimately, where the conversation led us was to the concept of, which do you focus on when, right? Do I focus on getting the right people, and then once I get them, focus on retaining them after I get them, or vice versa? And my point that I hold dear to me in terms of how this works is to figure out within your flight department, what is it that you have to offer? And once I understand what it is that I'm offering, now I can start to pretty accurately figure out who it is I need to recruit to come in and fill that role. Meaning, if I have a Friday, Saturday, Sunday type operation, I want to go find someone that naturally is going to be a good fit for that. So if I understand first what my flight department is offering, and I understand who it is that's going to fit into that well, I have by default figured out my retention strategy in a way that it aligns with my recruitment strategy. So they both go hand in hand. One does not necessarily come before the other, but they are working together so that when we bring someone on, we realistically know or are confident that they are going to fit well within our culture and stay.
Well said.
Yeah, I think there's also that cliche, James, that we talked about where you have to be self-aware enough to understand what you're offering in terms of, is this a job or is it a career? And you have to be extremely honest with yourself when you go out to industry with that, because I think that just to be transparent with your candidates about what their needs are and what your needs are.
That's a really good point, Jamie.
Yeah, if your operation, and I say this genuinely, not as a slight, but if your operation serves as a stepping stone to someplace better, and you can get clear with yourself on that, and you can get clear with the people that you're bringing in, you're going to have some of the hardest working people coming into that operation. While it may be for a shorter time, 1 or 2 years, right? Because you were clear with yourself and because you were clear with them, you have people that are happy to be there, that are working hard to be there, that are going to let you know when they're going to be transitioning out and will likely help you find their replacement. So if we can't necessarily retain people for an extended period of time, the least we can do is make the transition as seamless and as painless as possible. And that's actually okay.
Yeah, that's a good point too, James. Can you just kind of circle back now and go through the five takeaways just real quick to summarize everything we've discussed here?
Sure. So the biggest items that, like I said, I took away that I think if pilots use these to put on a whiteboard in their flight department and start a discussion, right, is number one, start to figure out where are the pilots, executives, and HR on the same page with language and where are they not on the same page. Number two, start to get your different generational groups together, right? And start to determine where is there conflict within the flight department in terms of what are the needs and wants of each individual. Once you understand that, start to define what your standard is for scheduling, quality of life, pay, and retirement that's going to satisfy the needs of the most of the people that you can in your flight department, with the understanding it's never going to be 100%. From there, how do you start to take this information that you have and insert transparency so that not only can you communicate it clearly within your organization, but can you communicate it clearly externally when you're looking to recruit and retain new people? And then lastly, step away from the data and start to look at what are the things that we cannot measure on an Excel spreadsheet: quality of life, scheduling, advancement opportunities, and start to put those once again on a whiteboard and start the process of weighting those, right? Give them some type of value that people can see and measure so that you can start to figure out what is actually important to the people that work here. And then how do we maximize getting them what's important to them? If folks can focus on those five areas, right, which are not small tasks, right, but are the path to getting from where they're at today in terms of having conflict, having turnover, to where they need to be, right, which is having people that are working there because they want to work there, right, and retaining them for as long as is comfortable for everyone involved.
We will have a written list of that on our website as well, in case you couldn't follow along and write while you were driving or something. But if you want to get in touch with James, you can go to ravencareers.com. All of his contact information is there. And I just wanted to say a special thank you to Jamie and the NBAA CAM Governing Board and NBAA. You know, they're serious about this. That was one of the takeaways I had from this luncheon, was that the department managers understand that it's almost a crisis at this point. You know, there is a lack of talent, and they're taking it head on. And so I salute you for letting us get involved, Jamie, and bringing in James and the expertise to help the managers. I salute NBAA. It sounds like they're headed in the right direction on this.
Yeah, they certainly are. I think they've made some really great strides with their salary survey. That's a part of the equation. They've promoted Joe D'Amato, who's a CAM, to Vice President of Educational Strategy and Workforce Development. They are very serious about this, and we thank them for taking the lead and helping us shape these discussions for probably years to come. But let me thank Dylan and Max for putting all this together and getting this kind of information out to the masses. You guys are doing a superb job. Keep it up.
Thanks, Jamie. It's truly our pleasure. It's what we like to do. So,
hey, Jamie, once again, you know, thanks a lot for inviting us out. And I'm real excited to kind of see some of the conversation this is going to kick up on the LinkedIn page in terms of what folks are doing that's working, what they're doing that's not working, and where their pain points are. Because I think there's going to be a lot of information to be gained from the successes and failures of everyone around us.
And we'd love to hear any feedback from any listeners that implement some of this stuff into their flight department and see how it ends up and works out. Please shoot us an email or get in touch on the socials, and we'd love to give an update to everybody else out there.
All right, fellas. Well, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it, James. And Jamie, we'll look forward to talking to you guys again soon.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Talk soon.
You know, Max, a few episodes ago, we had run that series on the loss of medical, and we talked about how it can really happen to any pilot, and also some of the ways that pilots can protect themselves with insurance and other ways. But we have recently received a message from Lori, who's a corporate recruiter at Flight Safety International, and she had mentioned the fact that they often hire pilots that have lost their medicals to become instructors. So we thought it'd be interesting to talk to them a little bit about exploring the opportunities. Maybe you did lose your medical and it's more of a permanent situation and there's not an opportunity to get it back. How can you still be involved in aviation, earn a living, and support your family? So today on the program, we've got Lori Napolitano. She's a corporate recruiter for Flight Safety based out in Teterboro. And also Jake Piazek, who's a program manager for the King Air program in Teterboro. So welcome to the program, Lori and Jake.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome, Jake and Lori. Yeah, thanks for making the time for us. We appreciate it.
So Lori, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do as a recruiter for Flight Safety?
Yes, certainly. My title is corporate recruiter, and my focus is on recruiting pilots for ground simulator instructor positions here at Flight Safety. We have, you know, various centers throughout the country and, in fact, throughout the world, but my focus is primarily here on the East Coast. And I am looking for qualified pilots that have an interest in becoming instructors for various reasons. Someone who's lost their medical and is looking to stay in aviation, or they can be someone that's retired from the airlines or, you know, is at retirement age, is looking for a second career. And because there is a consideration of work-life balance for a lot of young families, we also have some younger folks who are interested in joining Flight Safety as an instructor.
Can you walk us through the requirements for being an instructor? What kind of certificates do you have? Is there some minimum experience? How does that
yes.
work?
Yes. So to join the flight safety team as a pilot instructor to provide ground and simulator training, you must have an ATP if teaching on a type rated aircraft. Total pilot time of 2,000 hours or more is preferred. Not actually required, but definitely preferred. Commercial pilot certificate with instrument rating if teaching on an aircraft not requiring a type rating. In that case, a total pilot time of 1,000 hours or more are preferred. And a certified flight instructor rating or aviation ground instructor certificate with an instrument rating or prior experience is definitely a plus. Acceptable prior experience includes military pilot instructor or pilot instructor in a Part 142, 135, or 121 operation. And medical certificate is not required to be a ground sim instructor.
Yeah, that was kind of what sparked this whole conversation. So we're glad to hear that. My other question was, If you've never had any experience teaching before, no CFI or anything like that, obviously those qualifications are preferred, but it is still possible to become an instructor. Is that correct?
Correct. Most important is obviously having the flying hours is part of it, but also an attitude of wanting to teach and be part of a team and just be part of the culture of a training facility. So I think that can overcome a lot if the person has the attitude that they, you know, this is what they want to do. And once they understand what the position entails, if it's for them, then I think that goes a long way in having them be able to be successful.
Kind of give us an overview of, are some of the people only ground instructors, so in the classroom, or do they all also instruct on the ground and in the simulator, or do you hire for one or the other specifically?
Well, we typically like to hire people for the dual role of ground and simulator instructor. We do on occasion hire ground instructors, but for the most part, they're ground sim instructors, and that's typically the way, you know, the positions are advertised and what we're looking for. Now, as I said, on occasion, we will hire someone that has possibly a lot of ground experience if we have a need.
And one of the things I think we've always heard is it takes a long time to get somebody from walking in the door to trained up and turning them loose by themselves. Because we've all been in classes where there's people being observed and or in training and things like that. So what is the normal time frame from showing up the first day in the job to running your own class?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I want to defer to Jake on this because I'm not sure. I think sometimes it depends on the program. Would that be correct, Jake?
Yes, that's true. It would depend upon the program, but for the most part, a person walking in the door, we have a set plan of 6 months. Depending upon the individual, depending upon what they can, you know, handle and do, they have to learn the airplane if they don't have the experience. So we have like five phases they'll go through. They'll go through as a client, then they'll be, you know, observe the class again, be able to take more notes on, you know, that they're going to share with the classes. Then they'll do practice, you know, they'll practice teach. They'll have the presentations and their notes. And then they'll do a supervised instruction where they will work with a system matter expert, that's me, and help them fine tune the information that they're putting out. And then after that, they'll be, you know, they'll go for a qualification evaluation.
Okay.
Usually, though, on average, I would say it's probably four to five months is about the average.
Okay. And then also, will you normally try and place guys that have a bunch of time in a certain airplane? So if a guy flying a 650 comes in and says, I've been flying this and have 3,000 hours, will you put him in the 650 program? Or does that, maybe they start at the light jets and have to work their way up?
We try to, because that's valuable experience that they have. The same token, we have to look at what flight safety's needs are also. So currently right now we have in the Teterboro area Falcons and we have the King Air. We both need instructors, but the King Air program is actually expanding quite rapidly and is in pretty good dire need for King Air instructors. So if somebody does come in with 3,000 hours in a 650, you know, we always ask the question, but I would try to get him into the program that's going to be, you know, fulfill the need that flight safety has.
So let's follow up on that a little bit. I mean, for many of our listeners who are in business aviation, you know, we're always at the training center at least once a year. And we've seen it's difficult to find instructors right now, you know, with the economy, it's so good. And there's a pilot shortage. And so anyone that can fly is flying. Talk to us a little bit, Lori, about the marketplace out there and finding the talent to come instruct. I imagine that's got to be a challenge for you guys right now.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is. There's definitely a pilot shortage. Fact being that, you know, a lot of people are at retirement age, and it appears the younger generation is not going into aviation they did in the past. So it's definitely a challenge. So that is why we try to get the word out about the opportunities here at Flight Safety. I find that pilots, especially that have been involved in airlines, been flying for quite some time, they're not maybe aware of the opportunities that are available to them here at Flight Safety, possibly a second career as an instructor.
I imagine, and I've seen just on the pilot side, for those that are actively flying, the compensation and benefits packages have become more and more generous as the talent becomes more scarce. Has there been any changes on the training side, compensation and benefit packages for instructors?
Yes. The short answer is yes. We have adjusted salary ranges depending, you know, based on the geographic location. So they have been adjusted. A training facility is not going to be able to compete with an airline as far as salary.
Sure.
We have other things to consider, which is the work-life balance. Also, we are a Berkshire Hathaway company. We have an excellent, you know, total package. Our benefits are very good. And for someone who has an interest in being home, I think the overall package is very attractive.
Just to clarify, when you're talking about compete with the airlines, are you talking about in a parallel job as being a ground and sim instructor or as an airline pilot?
Yeah, to clarify, I'm talking about somebody leaving a pilot job
okay.
to become an instructor. Yeah.
Got it. Because I was curious too, whereas in business aviation, a lot of the big competition right now for pilots is with the big airlines. Do you guys have right. the same kind of deal with the training departments at the big airlines?
In terms of
competing for instructors or having attrition instructors going there, or are you getting instructors from the airlines that are coming to you, or what's the flow?
You know, they come from a variety of places. They can come from a direct competitor. They can have a very, you know, varied background. Some of the candidates they speak with have kind of gone back and forth between flying and instructing. So it really is on a case-by-case basis what we see and what an average candidate would look like.
I just wanted to add in on when you were talking about as far as pilots and pay and what's comparable, we also have other things that we do which are incentive pilot programs. So in other words, you become ground instructor and become a sim instructor. Well, now you're dual qualified, and that's a 3% pay bump. If you teach so many hours after that line that's, you know, it's identified for everybody, depending upon what your position is, then if you teach more than those hours per month, you get additional pay. So there's other incentives in there for them to help be comparable to every other job market out there.
Gotcha. Let's look at the pilots that maybe have lost their medicals, or maybe they're retiring from the airlines or their business aviation job. What a lot of pilots love is the ability to live wherever they want and commute to work. Is it possible for an instructor to be able to commute for a teaching position? Do you guys structure anything that way? How does that work?
Your commute that I think you're referring to is like they can live in Tampa, but their hub is in Newark. That's kind of hard to do. No, I don't think we really do that. But, you know, I live 45 minutes. Some people live an hour and a half away and commute back and forth. I don't think it'd be really smart unless you have a crash pad at that center.
Yeah, it sounds like it'd be tough. So what's a typical schedule look like for an instructor?
Well, we do have a quality of life initiative that we kind of strictly go by. So many days on, so many days off, so many hours. Depending upon the schedule, I mean, it could be something as much as you're working 3-4 days a week, you know, and you get a couple, 2-3 days off. Those hours, though, can range anything from 8 to 10 hours, depending upon if you're doing both the ground school and the simulator. So we have recurrence that'll come in, and it can be a 10-hour day by the time you get done doing all the paperwork. But then again, you're given an extra 3 days off, so it kind of balances out that way.
And is it a seniority process for figuring out who gets weekends off and those kind of things, or how did you actually create that schedule?
I created it based upon needs of what flight safety has. You know, we have the teaching going on all the time. It's a 24/7 operation. I try to make it fair for everybody across the board. You know, you're doing this, you're doing that. If you have requests that you need to have a certain day off or you need to take vacation time, man, we make it happen. So to answer your question, no, I don't do a seniority thing. I do who's available, and then you know, did he just teach last weekend? I'll find somebody else. You know, I try to make it even across the board.
The overall benefits and advantage of working for Flight Safety as an instructor, just to recap, are our comprehensive benefits program, our competitive compensation packages. As Jake mentioned earlier, opportunities for advancement based on performance, and our customer-focused and family-oriented culture, and chance to join a team that enhances aviation safety worldwide. So this platform gives you, you know, gives the chance for the pilots to give back to the industry that fuels their passion.
Laura, you forgot some of the most important benefits of all, which is usually the access to all of the coffee machines on every single
and
break.
Isn't there usually a free lunch every week at the training?
Yeah. Yes, and absolutely. And we have every kind of coffee machine and every kind of coffee pod you could imagine. So yes, that is
usually
definitely
there's
a
some fresh donuts in there every morning. Yeah, it's, lots of snacks. Yeah.
You can tell that Max and I have spent many, many, many hours at Flight Safety.
I think some of the guys that have a ton of experience over a long period of time, you know, some of the retired guys and things like that have been some of my best instructors while I've been there, because they can draw on so many things, not just to that specific type of airplane. And so those guys are really invaluable. And I think it's awesome that you guys are trying to provide an opportunity for people that do have a ton of experience. I commend you guys for going after those guys and trying to get the word out, because those guys a lot of times can turn out to be the best instructors for students that are looking to learn.
It is a great point, and we got, you know, we have instructors currently that, yeah, they do have those experiences that, and they share, especially like Lori said, as far as being typewritten in that airplane. You know, there's a lot of different things going on that some people from a jet that's going through a prop don't realize. Or the other way around, from a prop to a jet. There's differences, and you look at things a little bit different depending upon the airplane. So we look at that, and we listen to what the clients want and try to help them out the best we can.
How does it work if you're maybe living somewhere and you would want to transfer to another training center for whatever reason you need to move? Is it possible to transfer from training center to training center, or do they keep everyone in their own silos? No.
You can. So if somebody were to get hired on with us here at Teterboro, and they come up here, they learn the airplane, get, you know, teaching, and then they're like, okay, I want to go somewhere else, do something. You do have that capability of applying to a different center to be transferred there to that airplane if you'd like, or to be able to advance if you wanted to, you know, further your career within flight safety itself, because that's actually pretty good, I must say, the opportunities for advancement.
I think one of the other things, too, with that job, just from my experience in talking to instructors, is that for guys not that still have a medical certificate and can fly, flight safety actually encourages them to go out and fly the airplane on a contract basis or whatever to try and get experience that they can bring back to the classroom. But it's also a huge benefit for that employee to go out and get the education and stuff, but it's also certainly a significant stream of income. And in the current environment where we're so short on pilots, it's a great way to home every night if you want. And if you want to go fly, you can go fly. And it kind of gives you the best of both worlds. Is that, am I understanding that kind of correctly, guys?
Yeah, that's a true statement. And we encourage that because, just like you said, we want to be able to have them get that experience, because when you get clients walking into a room, I mean, you want somebody that can relate to what they're talking about. Well, in the airplane, we do this. Yep, you're right, because I saw that. Or maybe, you know, your flows need to be a little bit different. So it's a great opportunity on not only for the pilot instructor, but also for the people attending the class to be able to relate to them.
Yeah, not to mention you get it sometimes, or all the time, a very expensive typewriting, including recurrent training that's included as part of your job, which if you're an independent contractor, you know that there's a point every time you go to recurrent that you're working for free till you get to the break even on that training cost, which you don't have to do as an instructor at Flight Safety. That's already built in. So,
correct. That's a true statement. It's a great avenue that Flight Safety likes to have their instructors take part in.
Correct. And to your point, to the earlier question of relocating or going to different centers, we're very accommodating when it comes to that. So that is definitely a consideration and a benefit. If they, you know, are in one center and want to, as I said, if they want to move to a warmer climate, if an opening comes up and they, you know, want to leave Teterboro to go to Savannah, then typically we're, as I said, very accommodating on that front.
The winter transfer program, I like that. Maybe you can develop that for the...
Yeah.
Yeah, but I did it backwards. I came from Savannah to here. I don't know what was wrong with me.
That's right, Jake. That's right.
But it's the career progression. So to give you, just to emphasize that, I was a maintenance instructor down in Savannah. And to be able to apply for the pilot program manager position here and build this, I mean, that's how much flight safety actually encourages, you know, so anything and everything can happen.
Absolutely. Internal growth is definitely encouraged.
Well, thank you, Jake and Lori, for your time today. We certainly appreciate you coming on the show and explaining a little bit about the kind of the other side of aviation, some of the opportunities for pilots, again, like we said, that may have lost their medicals or retired or just looking to change things up.
Awesome. But we'll have Lori's contact information there in the show notes. Anyone looking to get in touch with her about a possible job at FSI.
Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks, guys.
And thank you for having us.
Our pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you guys for getting the word out. Appreciate it.
Well, we end every episode with a story. I don't really want to tell this story.
This is a good one that just happened a couple of days ago, actually. So Thanksgiving Day in the morning, late morning, we met at a park with all of our kids and stuff. We're going to have a big like pickup kickball game. And I brought this remote control airplane that I ordered off Instagram from China, which I've been suckered a lot into these advertisements on Instagram.
We need to start. What could we start now selling on Instagram? Maybe our snow brooms.
Nothing that would sell, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's shop now and then you buy. And I bought this airplane and they sent the wrong one. And so it's a whole thing now. But anyway, the one that we bought, it's like a little F-22, you know, foam remote control airplane. So I brought it to the park. And I was flying it around, and the only open area, it's kind of lined with trees around the perimeter, so you got to keep the turns tight. And I've let my 9-year-old son fly it, and he flies it great. It's something with video games. Those kids can pick up a remote control airplane and just fly it around. It's incredible. I let my 6-year-old son fly it. He did great. You know, didn't crash into the trees or anything. And Dylan picks the thing up. He goes, oh, let me try. And he flies it around. He gets it high, and then he's flying around in circles, and it. And I can see, I'm like, dude, you better get it away from the trees. And all of a sudden, whack, right into the top of a tree.
There's no ailerons. You can only control it with differential thrust. It's very difficult to get those turns.
Yeah. Well, I just thought it was comical that the professional pilot crashes the airplane into the trees and gets it stuck and just sucks the wind out of my poor kid's sails with their airplane. And it takes 30 kids. Days to get another one direct from China.
That thing was really high up, too. We thought about climbing the tree. It was like probably, 40 or 50 feet up?
Yeah,
it was
the best. Dylan goes, just boost me up. I'll climb it. I'm like, dude, at this stage of our lives, you can't take a risk climbing a tree to retrieve a $40 radio controller. But I go, how great of a story is this going to be on the podcast when, you know, you haven't quite worked out your deal with Harvey Watt yet, and you end up getting a concussion and losing your license, your medical for 3 years to try and save $40.
A bummer.
So then he gets the genius idea of throwing the basketball up to knock it loose. Subsequently gets the basketball stuck in the tree like an idiot.
Yeah, one by one, all of the kids' toys eventually ended up in that tree.
But tell what happened.
The good news is, so we had a huge storm over Thanksgiving here in Phoenix, and I ended up driving to the park the next day after the storm, and I'm like, maybe I had this big pole in the back of my car. I was going to get the basketball out because that was at a low branch. So I went over there, and I'm like driving up to the park, and on the side of the road, probably a couple hundred yards from the tree, I look over and I see the airplane just sitting on the ground. And I'm like, no way. And I run over and grab it. And it was just sitting. And it must have blown out of the tree somehow. I don't know. We tried to power it out of the tree. We were doing all sorts of stuff, throwing pine cones at it. And nothing would work. And sure enough, Mother Nature took care. You know, I was contemplating getting your drone out and trying to do some type of emergency drone.
Yeah, take a $1,000 drone and try and get the $40.
Yeah.
What? Did you get the basketball?
No, basketball was long gone. I figure somebody probably picked it up.
Oh, it fell out though? Wasn't it?
Yeah, it was gone. Yeah. Someone probably grabbed it out of, you know, it was probably sitting on the ground and they just grabbed it. But the airplane was kind of camo, so it kind of blended in. And if you weren't looking for it, I couldn't believe it. I saw it from the side of the road. I couldn't believe it and jumped out. I was so excited.
It was missing a prop though, but.
Now, listen. That's why it's got two engines, two motors.
Anyway, leave it to the pros.
Yeah, right. So I'm good. I think I'm good. I already ordered a replacement for your kids, though. So now I'm going to have one. So I don't think the skies are safe. I think we'll have to really pare that one down. I'm going to stick to drone flying and something like that where I have a little bit more control. But they are actually kind of fun. We'll put a link in the show notes for these things. They're really, there's all it is all you have control over is the output on the motors.
Well,
and then it's got two, right? So you
One I ordered has elevons, so it lands on water. It was like $10 more. It's so much cooler, and they sent me the wrong one. So I'm currently,
it's pretty fun though. If you've got a kid
with my friends in China,
yeah, we'll see. Yeah, we'll give you an update here in 3 months when it shows up on the new one that can land on water. But pretty fun if you're looking for something fun for your kids to fly around. It's pretty easy. Well, for a child,
yeah, real easy.
Let your kid fly it. You stay grounded. Well, that's going to do it for another episode of the 21.5 show. Thank you so much to all of our guests who joined us today. Clint, we're so happy you're back in the air with your medical. Good luck in training.
Thanks to James and Jamie for our discussion with the CAM governing board recap.
And to Jake and Lori from Flight Safety for sharing those opportunities.
And don't forget, for the remainder of the year, Harvey Watt is offering $150,000 of life insurance to pilots and their spouses with no medical exam and no exclusions, except for suicide, which is removed after 2 years. Just answer a brief health questionnaire to enroll. We'll put a link in the show notes where you can click for all the details. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
You can find us on Instagram. It's at 215 Podcast. We're posting all sorts of great content. Did you see the Instagram story we put out?
Yeah. Why would you put that out of the champagne bottle?
You said you were going to do that. For those of you who haven't seen it, you might have missed it because it doesn't stay up there very long. We talked about the Cloud9 Bistro in Aspen.
Oh, that's right. We did on the destination guide.
Yes. And I had a couple good videos of the crazy party up there when we were up there a few years ago skiing and Max just exploding or just spraying a champagne bottle over everybody.
Over a whole crowd of people.
It was really one of a kind. A lot of comments from our listeners on that one. Everyone was in support. So
they were?
Yeah, they loved it. So if you didn't get a chance to see that on our stories, let me know and I'll send it to you. It was good stuff. Also, you know, one other platform that we really haven't plugged, we're on LinkedIn as well. And I've really found that that's where we get a lot of engagement because that's where all the professionals are.
Because we're professionals. Yeah, that's right.
Clearly. So you can find us on LinkedIn. Just search for the 21.5 podcast and we share a lot of good content there and get a lot of good discussions going there as well. I think that's going to do it. So until next time, remember,
flexibility is the key to air power.
See you guys.
Later.